I actually had a chat with Stuart Wilkinson on this podcast. He's the CEO of Rightway, which is actually an accountant and business advisory firm that reached a certain scale that is very rare for that type of business. So there's a lot of lessons in that, especially around humility as a leader. He went from being a sales manager to working his way up the ranks to being the CEO of Rightway, and brings quite a unique take on balancing the numbers, having sort of a strategic overview, using his sales skills. So seemed like a genuine, lovely bloke. And I actually learned a lot in this podcast. You know, you have to relearn it to learn it again. And you're like, oh, shit, why am I not doing that? Oh, I got to do more of that. And if you haven't subscribed to the newsletter, we put all the good content in one place. You just click the link in the subscription and you get a free book while doing it. So why not? That made no sense, but whatever. You know, there's a link somewhere down there. Click it and we'll click into it. Well, we've got Stuart. I think it's always... it's almost a tradition to start things out by like, who are you? What do you do? So then everyone knows why they're listening.
Yeah.
So who are you? What do you do? Sure.
I know. And I've listened to some of your previous ones, Ryan, and we can get pretty deep, it sounds, on this sort of conversation. So obviously, Stuart, I'm CEO of Rightway. But I think if I go back to the start, you probably can tell from my accent, I'm not from New Zealand. I'm from the UK, down from Devon, which is the southwest of the UK. But my family's all Scottish, so I actually class myself as Scottish. For my sins, I'm a very passionate Scottish rugby fan, which for Kiwis, I think the closest kind of way they can empathise with that is probably by being a Warriors fan. It's a very similar emotional rollercoaster of
it's tough.
Well, huge hope and some big lows. Anyway, my background is, at school I was pretty sporty, enjoyed sport. Probably didn't study quite hard enough. And then I got to uni and I did business and management, or commerce, I guess you guys call it over here. And I kind of enjoyed that. And from that, left uni not having really a clue what to do. And then I thought I will do something a bit different. My parents actually moved to New Zealand. And so I thought, okay, well, we'll go and give this a crack. Came on a 1 year working holiday visa, which was 16 years ago now. And I started at a firm called Bartercard as an account manager. I was just, real entry, graduate kind of role, looking after about 100 clients and trying to get them to utilize Bartercard. So started there. And then 10 years later, I left as national sales manager. So I did a bunch of branch management and been in marketing, moved to Rightway. And I came in initially as sales manager to help the partners sell, because accountants are not known for their sales skills.
Very diplomatically said.
Well, some are really good though. Some naturally are really good, but some are not. And they shy away from the word sales. I think they think it's a dirty word. It's the old car salesman, I think, comes in. But we're always, as I say to them, you can have all the accountants you want and you can count the numbers, but if there ain't sales, there's pretty much nothing to count. So sales is pretty important, you know, as we know, Ryan. And then from that and a few changes and stuff, kind of ended up managing our Upper North Island region. And then just over a year and a half ago, became the CEO when Graham, our owner, moved back from the business a bit more. I've ended up, I don't quite know how, the CEO of an accounting company, but as a sales background. So yeah, that's my background.
You sold your way to the top, man.
I sold my way. I can swear on this, Scott. Yeah, I can.
Yeah, you do.
Maybe a bit of bullshitting on the way, but no, I think it's interesting because there's plenty of examples, I guess, of people that they're very good at knowing something, but it doesn't mean you're a good leader or a good manager or a good owner or whatever in business. And so, luckily I've got some really, really good people around me who luckily do know lots about accounting, so that's cool. But that's part of our role, I think, as leaders, is to make sure you've got the best team around you who can complement, make sure you've got technically good skills on whatever you do and whatever you're trying to produce. But at the end of the day, my role, I think, is about hopefully providing a bit of direction and making sure we've got an environment to do our best for our people, and then that hopefully flows through some good outcomes for customers, in simple terms.
Wow, man. This is a very, very beautifully encapsulated
story
of your life.
We're deep there, Ryan. Oh, yeah.
Well, you said sport. What sport?
I kind of was a classic kid of I'll give everything a go. So, but rugby was my main one, actually. So
halfback, surely.
No. In the UK, we call it inside centre, but second 5'8 was yeah. So I played.
So you had nice boots, never touched the mud.
No, I was a pretty hard runner, Ryan. Actually, even with my short stature, I was not. It was funny because you know, I wouldn't say I grew fast, but I was, you know, when I was under 13s, I was always about the same height, and then when I got to first 11, I was like, oh, I'm a bit you know, when you get the school, you know, the rugby photo at the end of the year, I started in more in the middle, and then I'm like, Jesus, I'm getting really down to the low points here of the short people. So I was always a bit short, actually, for my side, but I was all right. I played first 15 and played county back in the UK.
Oh.
Yeah, so, and then I sort of found probably like a few people going out and university and that kind of thing. But yeah, so rugby was a big part, cricket. And then later in life, I've gone into a bit more golf and running and that sort of stuff.
So. Golf, that's a big switch out. Our lives weren't too dissimilar. So I was 5'6", under 50 kilos, so like 19.
Yeah.
Then like double, just more of the waist than the height. And I was a blindside flanker. But there was a turning point for me when I realized when I run with the ball, it doesn't matter how much I weave. It doesn't matter how much I like try to avoid being picked up. I just get picked up because everyone was doubling my weight.
Yeah, it's funny how it goes because I'm literally the same size as what I was when I was 18. Yeah. Like nothing's changed. So I was okay, but yeah, it was a bit small. But yeah, I love rugby and I probably the focus was a bit too much on sport maybe at my academic rather than my academic studies, but I did all right. And at uni, I played rugby right through uni as well. Hmm. And that's actually where I picked up golf as well, was at uni with mates. And so, yeah, you know, but sport's always been a big part of my life. My dad's always been, our family's always been really into sport. As I said, passionate Scottish rugby fans, which, is emotional. But yeah, love sport.
What would you say your lessons are? Because we had the marketing manager.
I listened to that one actually.
Oh, did you end up rolling?
Yeah.
What are your lessons from sport? Like, what do you take from it?
It's interesting because I you know, through my career, it was always team sport. And then I guess after I got out of uni, that's when I kind of stopped playing rugby and stuff. I still play social cricket, but then I've tried golf, which I guess more individual. And then I got into running. I haven't run for about 3-4 years properly now, but I've done a couple of marathons and stuff. Very individual, very different. And I think those different types of sport give you different lessons. I think there's no doubt as team sports, huge applications of business about, hey, we're a team here trying to achieve one goal. You know, hey, and it's we're all clear what the vision is. It's winning the game. But we've got to have a plan. We've got to buy into it. And we understand what our piece of the puzzle is, you know. And if we don't, then we're not on the same page. So I think, you know, the strength and numbers of different skill sets, especially rugby. I think it's the beauty of rugby, isn't it? You know, I could be a prop, still have I've got a huge role to play in my particular part, but that's very different to a scrum half, different skill sets. But we need those skills to get the outcome we want. And I think that's in business is very similar. So I think the team and be able to identify different skills. But I also think, you know, sport in general, it teaches you a bit about adversity, you know. You know, and when you're you know, 17, 18, it is your world, and so when you lose a game, it's pretty important, you know, and rightly so. So you think it's quite humbling, I think, sometimes, you know, and so you've got to go, well, how do I do this? And I think it also teaches you a bit about hard work. You can't cheat yourself in sport, you know. There was all probably kids that were naturally pretty good, but you also saw people that went on to good things. They worked hard. And I think that's a good lesson as well.
I'll say a quote like, hard work beats talent when talent fails to work hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's true to that.
Yeah. And I think like Jack Nicklaus had a quote, the harder you practice, the luckier you are. And I think that's a bit of that. You know, if you put the hard yards in, it'll reward you. And I think I saw that with running. Like running is a very humbling experience. Like, you know, when shit goes wrong when you're running and you know I'm 30k's into this marathon, I've got 10 to go and I am in pieces, there's nowhere to hide. And it comes back to your training. Like, you've got to train hard. I did this presentation once to our sales team about running, because in sales, you know, it's very competitive. It's very much, okay, am I on the leaderboard with sales? Whereas running is, you're not going to win the marathon. Like, that's pretty obvious. But it's about personal, I want to achieve X. And so you've got to set you know, and you cannot skip your beats of training. There is no way of fast tracking your running training marathon. And so I think it is about practice, reflection, what went well in that run, what didn't. You look at diet, you look at all these things to get an outcome. And I think sales is very much like that. You know, hey, I'm working with this client, didn't land that sale. What have I done wrong? What do I need to practice? What do I need to get better on? I think that's a really good lesson, because in business, it's very easy to reflect, I think, and very, very easy. I'll skip on to the next one and just not reflect and view things. So I think sport gives you a lot. There's a lot of tangents to business. And I've always looked for learning in sport.
Yeah, well, I mean, I even used, when I first started training a sales team, so that's what I used to do, was started commissionally sales because I was petrified of people. Still petrified, but got better at it.
Yeah.
So then the good thing is, because I was a shit salesman and then a okay salesman, I knew that how to get from here to here, so I could teach it.
Yeah.
And we were using the same core values, like leave it all on the floor.
Yeah.
So when you're at work, you put in everything so then you can go home and not think about it.
Mm.
Practice how you play.
Yeah.
So, you know, the role playing that everyone hates to do, we do it.
It's
like
so important.
Yeah. You got to practice it. But I was curious what your thoughts on, because you said something interesting there around competition and sales. Personally, because this was a lesson for me, is that I was competing and sabotaging the others so I could win.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on either competing on attributes, so KPIs of, you know, delivering on the certain process as opposed to results, or how do you navigate healthy competition?
There's plenty out there about this now, isn't there, about, you know, incentive schemes and all that sort of stuff around sales. When I first took on management of a sales team, because my original management was more account management, then I went to set, like, kind of new sales as such. We had some commissions only sales, and there was, you know, we had the classic situation of some people who were absolute hammers and they would nail numbers, but they would like walk over, you know, their second born to do it. Like, and, you know, it's, well,
I believe you.
If we've worked with commission itself, you've probably seen it. And you're like, is this, so you go, great, we're getting a good result because these people are delivering some numbers and some conversions and that sort of stuff. But it's not healthy, you know, and there's, from a values point of view, from a cultural point of view of the business, it can be pretty combative. So I think there's got to be a balance. At the end of the day, whatever we like it or not, in my view, we're business, you know, we are about results. We are trying to deliver an outcome. Now, I think it is still important that you look at the intent of how you get that outcome. And I guess what you're talking about around the process and the attributes to lead up to it, I think it's still really important, because competitions can be a healthy thing, but when it goes across that line and you're suddenly not helping your teammates and you're suddenly like, actually, I just want to win here.
Yeah.
It's got huge triple effects. And it's also, as an organization, if you're holding these people in high esteem, it's just sending to the message to the rest of the people going, right, it's all on me, screw the rest of you. So you're probably not going to get great outcomes. So I think there's a balance. And I think it also probably a little bit on where, you know, as you come into a business or a new role, you want to encourage good behaviors and more focus on those leading KPIs more than, hey, cool, we know if we do this, the results will come. So let's just focus on this. But then I think at the end of the day, you know, results are what we're here for.
Yeah, well said. Well, I think there's a good lesson in there as well around not being afraid to let the top performer go.
Yeah.
You know, like if you are rowing on a boat and there's someone rowing harder, okay, yeah, they're doing good, but the boat's going nowhere.
Yeah.
And the collective will outpower the individual.
Correct.
Have you ever had a tough moment like that where you've had someone that wasn't good for culture and how you either saved it or got rid of them?
It was just before I took over as national sales manager at Barleycard, actually. There was a bit of a culture that was some people that were, they were good, but they were sabotagers, as we call it.
Yeah.
And one of them left. And it was, but it actually got to the point where everyone was over it, you know, and the CEO at the time was supportive of it, you know, and said, look, we can't carry on like this, you know, that the team they were part of was having lots of churn of their staff because of this person and stuff. So at some point, you know, I think there's tipping points for all organizations where, and I think that's healthier. We're a lot more healthier space now where we look at values and culture a lot more as a lot more prominent and important part. It's a hugely important part of business rather than probably what we did 10 years ago. That, cool, you're not part of this culture. This is detrimental to what we want to do. And like you said, Ryan, it's all very well one person achieving, but if it is affecting that team or the wider business and causing people to leave, people to be unhappy. Like I have a biggest motto in my view of, like, just because you're having a shit day at work doesn't mean everyone else should have a shit day at work. Like, you know, we've all got lives, we've all got things that have happened in them, and we want to be supportive. But most people are turning up to work to do the best they can and do a really good job and do their best. And so if people are affecting that, is that cool? Probably not. So you get down to simple theories about that. And when you look at some salespeople that have probably been really detrimental to people going, am I really want to be here? That ain't good. Yeah.
Well, they're I think Emily Russ, organizational psychologist, she talks about psychological safety.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, because there's a balance there. On one hand, you had leaders there that had this mindset, never let anyone see you bleed. You know, like, oh, yeah, I've got all-knowing oracle of life.
Yeah.
How do you navigate creating a space where its vulnerability and emotion is valuable, but not at the expense of others? Like, where do you draw the line? Or
I think there's a couple of there's a limit of levels to that, Ryan. And I think, you know, last 3 years we've seen that a lot in team. Like, we've seen it as our organization at Right Way, you know, of lockdowns, the flow and effects of what that's done to people. We've had that, whether it's people who live on their own navigating that right through to people with families. I've got two young kids. I can, you know, this is not probably a secret, but two young children are not great for working at home productivity, you know. So, but that all has an impact on you know, whatever's going on with their spouses and their jobs and all that kind of stuff. So we've had this really intense cauldron of, I guess, what tests our psychological safety. Because I guess for me, the basic term when you use something like that term is are people comfortable to talk to their manager or a peer or whoever and say, I'm not good here. This isn't, and that's whether it's mentally or whether from a well-being point of view or whether it's, I'm, you know, when we look at the lockdown. And so I think one of the things I'm a big believer is, and I guess, you know, you get influenced by previous managers and all that sort of stuff. I worked with a manager who was, home life was home life and business work was work, and they never met. And he would speak a little bit about his home life, but it was more a token. And when he asked, oh, hey, Ryan, how was your weekend? It was the question you ask when you do your start the one-on-one. It wasn't really because I need to know as such. And I always struggle with that because, you know, and I can't remember what the saying was, but it's literally, you know, we talk about work-life balance, but someone used the term, it's work-life integration, isn't it? Like they work and together. And I think the reason I sort of say that is, I think as leaders, you set the tone of you need to be a bit open, you need to be transparent, you need to. So I felt it was really important, for example, when we're doing our team calls in the middle of lockdowns, just to be kind of saying, yep, it's a bit of a struggle with the kids at the moment, because I wanted to, I guess, show that, look, I'm not in this big ivory tower. Like, what you're going through, I go through, we're all humans. Just because I've got a title on my email signature doesn't mean I'm any different to any of you. So I think as leaders, we've got to be open. We've got to be a bit vulnerable in that. I'm a big believer in that. We've got to show that if we're willing to share and be a bit vulnerable, then people go, okay, this organization will listen, and they're okay with that. I think if people put up walls, and blokes were a bit, we're not great at that. We're always, she'll be all right and tough. I think it's, as leaders, we've got to set the tone a little bit about that. And so, yeah, that was a bit of a ramble. Right? That's a huge topic. A huge topic. Although we've partnered for a while with a business channel, CHNNL, which is kind of they've just been in the tech ward. So it's about they've created a platform for kind of daily check-ins for your team and stuff. And they talked a lot about us through, you know, the psychological safety and that sort of workplace. And I think one of the things they talked to us about is often at work, and we've all probably had this with staff where people are not doing great from a well-being point of view, is as a business, you obviously want to take on some responsibility of how do we help that person, but we can't solve the problem for them. Like, at the end of the day, they've got to put some stuff we can support them with, EAP or whatever it might be. But that's a challenge. Like when you've got people not great and you open up that conversation, you've also got to be willing to go, okay, let's have a chat about it and help be able to deal with that conversation. You can't go, let's chat, and then go, oh, geez, Ryan, that's a bit deep. Let's not speak about that. So, you know, there's kind of a couple of layers to this, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of see mental health as not a person's fault, but their responsibility.
Because
that's an important distinction, is if someone's crossing your boundaries and you're not showing good habits in itself. So if someone's unleashing all their vulnerabilities and fears on you consistently to a point where it's having an impact on you, you're actually modeling bad behavior.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But it is a balance. It is like, hey, I want to hear it. Hey, this is what my capacity and what I can do is.
Yeah.
But I can facilitate that with someone else. I love it. The problem is, like, even if it's 2 a.m. in the morning, someone's talking about their emotions, I'm just like engaged. So I know I'm not.
So
like,
just find Ryan. He'll sit there.
Yeah, call me. Probably. But I'd be interested as well, like, because, you know, Right Way's reached a certain level of scale. And I know you guys are sort of a jumbled up combination of accountants and other things and business advisory. But how the hell did that happen? How did you guys suddenly get above what the others are doing?
How long we've got. So our story, we're going back to, coming out 11 years now. And it started with four blokes in the Wairarapa of all places. And they operated two separate accounting firms. And they were pretty stock standard accountancy firms in the Wairarapa. They knew each other and they went to the second ever ZeroCon, which is like Christmas for accountants in reality. But it's their big, you know, it's a big thing now. Back then it was in Taupo, I think. Okay. And now they're at like New Orleans and that sort of stuff. And they said, Xero's going to change this for us. Because what Xero's done for, and most people know that, we've got, you know, 300,000 clients in our businesses, in New Zealand are on Xero. That's a huge portion of our market. 50% of clients of businesses in New Zealand are on Xero. But most people are aware of this now. But what Xero's done, rather than you rocked up to the accountant in September and you're talking about what happened from the previous year, well, what use of that is to you really? Mm. Now we can advise and talk to our client about the present, what's happening today, and use that data for better understanding around cash flow, better understanding about margin, and talk for, okay, what are we going to do about it? So they recognized that, but I guess they sort of also saw that the traditional model of a sole practitioner or a couple of partner firms was pretty limited in its growth. It would always hit a plateau. You know, you take on some clients, but then you're doing a bit of staff management. You're still doing technical work yourself. You're still, then managing workflow in the firm. So you're getting to a plateau that's always going to get there. So we kind of looked a bit differently and sort of separated out to a bit more of a corporate structure where our partners were not the top of the tree trying to do everything. They were separate and into separate advisors. Then we had our accounting teams to the side. So that's how it started. Went off gangbusters, you know, grew about 100% each year for a couple of times.
Why? How? Do you know? You weren't there, eh?
No, I was at the back of that real fast growth. Like, momentum's a big thing. And look, and I guess Greg, who was one of the founders, he was really good at sort of from the marketing and PR of it. So we got a lot of publicity. We were pretty early on in a couple of things, like fixed fee, monthly pricing and accounting. Now is pretty common for it, but we were one of the first to do that. Hmm. We were one of the first practices in probably globally, which was a Xero only firm. So I guess we were on the coattails of Xero. As Xero picked up, most firms, they would have been on some other MYOB most likely, whereas we were kind of the shining light for Xero. So anyone that wanted to do a Xero, we kind of were well known and kind of Xero prop, you know, we got publicity around that kind of stuff. Gotcha. We were Xero partner of the year and all that kind of stuff. So it really, really grew really fast. But like growth's hard. Like, and I think most people underestimate it. Like things that were small issues become massive issues. And we got caught up, and most people, yes, most companies can go through this, is we got caught up with that any sale was a good sale and any sale is not a good sale. No. So, you know, we've had to unwind a lot of that. We made mistakes and I think it's, you know, in my role, you know, we all sit there and we don't want to talk about mistakes, but every business has them. You know, we talk about in sport, don't we? We learn from defeat more than we do success. So we've had our challenges out of that. But I think fundamentally, we had a model which wasn't pinned on the traditional kind of structure, which means that we had a bit more flexibility. We've changed that a little bit in the sense we're now more regionalized. We have our regionalized teams and that sort of stuff, which still provides some scalability to us, which is cool. So yeah, I think it was, we were early adopters of technology. We were a bit forward thinking, but we made plenty of mistakes on the way.
Oh yeah. Well, in order to be successful, you need to be making mistakes. So what would you say, like, let's say someone's in Right Way, what is the infrastructure or incentive for them to be a part of it? Because that's going to be the challenge with an accounting firm, is like, what are you going to do for me? Like, why should I could do this, have this income, convenience, support, leads. What do you think would be Right Ways?
I think the thing with it's funny with the accounting industry, because they think the accounting industry thinks it's really different. But the reality is, we, you know, if you look at any professional service, whether it's lawyers, marketing agency, what do we all do? We sell time for expertise.
Yeah.
So whether it's marketing agency, whether it's IT consulting or whatever, where I'm in some form of model like that, it's the same. And so I guess when we look at, we're no different to any other business when we look at, well, how do we get good talent? You know, like all industries at the moment, getting good people is really hard for us at the moment. We're in, you know, most clients we speak to, that's the number one thing that they're struggling with. So I guess it comes back to what most people look for is, what's the culture of the organization? What's my growth opportunities to develop? We, you know, for example, we prioritize for a lot of our junior staff in particular, you know, start to get really used to dealing with customers and clients. You know, a lot of firms lock the junior staff pretty far away from clients, so it's behind the scenes, and so that's a big draw card for us. Flexibility has been one of the things. Like, flexibility is, I guess, was built from day dot in Right Way, so now it's become a lot more mainstream. But we have a lot of 70 odd percent of our workforce is female. We have a lot of working mums, and so the flexibility of that we've been able to provide from the day dot. We've always been cloud-based for 10 years, which I say these things now and it's like, oh yeah, everyone does that. But, you know, you think pre-pandemic, there was people panicking of how they're going to operate, you know? And so that has allowed us to attract some different people. A lot of working mums, as I say, we've got a degree of part-timers, and that's got some really good people. And I think because we've been a little bit different, people have got maybe a bit frustrated with the industry and gone, I want something a bit different. So that's pretty important. So, but it comes down to, we're no different to anyone else. You know, do I feel valued? Have I got career opportunities? Am I going to be, what's my culture like? What's the management and leadership of the organization like? And again, have we got that right all the time? No, but we keep trying to be better. You know, as long as all you can do, wake up the next day and try a bit better, isn't it?
Yeah. I didn't mean to make you sell yourself. I was just curious.
But if you want to be an accounting job, just check out rightway.co.nz. Yeah, we're always after good people. Yeah.
Rightway.co.nz.
Yeah, that's the one.
Well, that's an interesting thing, because when I came into this industry, you know, I was just trying to learn about money. And then I looked at it, I was like, shit, this is it. It's a dying industry, essentially. The investment planning service, especially. Yep. You know, the average advisors 45-57, give or take, and then they're, you know, single practices, and they're struggling to bring in talent because that's just an overhead to them and it's not really a scalable business. And so I was like, okay, well, one, we're gonna have a client acquisition issue, because, you know, it takes a certain amount of time. You get 1% of revenue, like 1% of the funds under management, so nothing happens for a while. You put all this love into this person and they leave. So I'm just wondering, in your industry, what are the biggest pain points? Would it be client acquisition and staff?
I would say, yeah. Staff at the moment is pretty challenging for us. Yeah, and I think, you know, we're not the only industry. You just open up the Herald every kind of second day and there's normally a staff thing about the Great Resignation or whatever. But talent's really, really challenging for us. Growth's an interesting one for us, to be honest. And I think accounting is kind of, it's you don't change your accountant often, you know, it's, you know, something's got to, I wouldn't say quite bad's going to happen, but there's different stages potentially in your career, your business life cycle that might change that. But, it is a relationship that you've got to think about and you want some certainty around. There's a huge amount of trust with it as well. You know, if you think about it, we see everyone's financial results of our clients. And, you know, it's that's quite a transparent thing, you know, and so there's a huge responsibility there. So I think for us, you know, a lot of our new work, our new clients come from referral. That's, you know, probably similar to you, Ryan. Referral is a big thing. We do quite put a bit of emphasis on digital and content as well. And the fact that we actually, you know, have a marketing acquisition strategy, because the way I simplify our marketing is all I'm trying to do is plant a seed in someone's mind that, my accountant doesn't do that for me. Because the minute I've got that, because a lot of people go, oh, how's your accountant? Oh, they're great. What are you comparing that to? Nothing. But they've, in my perception, they're great. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But the industry has moved a long way. And there are still a lot of very traditional firms that will do, speak to you once a year. They'll do your tax and compliance. It's a time and cost. You don't know quite what the bill is going to be. And for some people, that's exactly what they want. And so, cool. But there's a bunch of people that probably still don't know that I can get that on a fixed fee. You can actually, I can help you understand your financials better. I can actually talk to you a little bit maybe about what the future holds, maybe get our understanding of some cash flow, you know, all the things like cash flow. You know, you can look at Xero do these quarterly, and they aggregate all their data from all their users, and they do their quarterly update on their stats of what's the trends we see. And cash flow, something like 50% of Xero, so we're talking about 50% of 300,000 odd businesses, so 150,000 businesses have negative cash flow in Xero Sub. So cash flow for businesses in certain industries now especially get a real challenge. So actually getting in there, helping people understand that, the levers behind that, vitally important. So, and that's moving into this, the buzzword in accounting advisory.
Yeah. Well, if I unpack what you said in terms of Rightway's growth was probably a combination of strategic partnerships and being innovative and probably obsessing over your clients to lead to continue referrals and taking on clients you probably shouldn't. And then like, shit, we got this scale, what do we do? That'd be interesting. So that trend you talked about, is there other things that you see like that lead to a business's downfall in a way? Or what leads to their success?
There's a lot of questions there. Like, lot to unpack. What do I see with clients? So we deal with, you know, everyone right up, you know, what's our biggest client? Probably about 10 million in turnover. There's only one or two of those. But, you know, most 500K to 2 mil, you know, so they're, you know, solid SME New Zealand businesses. You know, we our biggest industry is professional services. So that's marketing agencies, lawyers, all that kind of stuff. There's lots of huge band. Second's trades, and then we're into retail and stuff. So it's pretty stock standard New Zealand businesses. What I guess see, Ryan, is business owners are often everything to that business. I'm the HR manager. I'm the CEO. I'm doing the books. I'm customer inquiries. I'm a bit of everything. And there's certain traits that kind of come when certain industries of expectations, which are not good things, you know, as well, that kind of lead to that. But I think the one thing, and I guess this links to very much your business, and we talked about this in the prep, but a business is an asset. But the reality of most business owners, they are not building their business for an exit of some kind. And it's understandable because they're dealing with a day. I'm wearing 5 million hats. I've got Bob who's crashed the truck, so I've got to try and sort that out because I've got deliveries to do. I've got these client inquiries to sort out. I'm trying to hire a new staff because we can't get anyone, so I'm down doing that job. That's you know, and you get that in people that are running million plus businesses. So they've got some numbers going through. It's significant. And I guess the downfall is the bigger you get, the variance of some issues can then have bigger impacts. You know, cash flow suddenly becoming, you know, people not paying you on time can suddenly really put pressure. What we're seeing with a number of clients now, inflation, you know, the core product getting up in price. Are they really understanding the margin to put that onto better pricing strategies? Most people know. So I think the downfall is for businesses, it can be a number of things, but at the end of the day, if people get behind on the cash flow, it's, you know, it's, I think there's this perception for people who are not in business the business has just produced these mountains of cash or something, you know. But I'll tell you, I guess, to illustrate cash flow, and I think that, you know, a couple of clients I've met in the last 2 weeks are both on, both of them import very different products. One has, both have, because of supply chain issues, have had to get what they can, and what they would normally be ordering every quarter from overseas, they're probably ordering now once a year. And they, so they're ordering something that's now taking up to 6 months in advance to deliver. So I'm forking out a bunch of cash.
Yeah.
It lands in 6 months. I've got more than I normally would. So I've now got to sell that over the next 3 to 4 months. So you, I've got to, so they've got to cash flow that. And I'm, and so those strains and understanding of what that impact is and the decision making on should I buy this, should I not, the amount of stock people are now holding on the shelf, which is understandable because they wanted to be able to deliver their customer because they haven't got the product, I'm not making any money. But that's the challenges that businesses are going through at the moment. And I think if you get that working capital cycle wrong, and I'm buying stuff so far in advance that I can't now pay my wages, often the one that goes is I can't pay my tax. And if, you know, most people, if they're going to liquidation, it's the IRD or the bank that's going to put you there. It's hard to catch up that model. So cash flow is what does it for people. And that links back to a number of things, which we could spend hours talking about.
Yeah. But, yeah. Hey, mate, you did it well. Articulate. I've heard cash flow a few times, but that was well. And I think that that's one of the most important things I got out of that was around the job component where, you know, business owners have jobs, not businesses.
Yeah.
And even if it's taking a cut into your income as an opportunity to remove a job you don't enjoy, because I think that's what burnout really is doing things either you're not good at, you don't enjoy.
Mm.
And what's that worth to you? And then if I can replace, yeah, that's my goal. Anything I don't want to do, I just don't do it.
Oh, hey. I try to do that. Yeah, yeah.
It's a balance though. So it's there ways around it. So like, because I know, like, you know, you can communicate with someone and you can build a relationship that isn't necessarily monetary, and that could incentivize. You could give an equity share. You could have a percentage share when a certain thing happens. Is there things for those, you know, 500 to 300, 3 million that are stuck in that spot that they can make a conscious effort to sort of remove themselves strategically?
Yeah, it's funny. I literally on Tuesday, I had a meeting with a client about this very conversation, and they've grown, they're a $2 million business. They've built up over the last 20 years and it's a really good business. They've done some cool things, real cool stuff. But they're at the age going, well, what's the exit strategy? And I think the thing I would say about exit is, you know, when we look at when you sell your house, it's a simple transaction. Here's the house. I go to a real estate agent and I move on. With businesses, there's lots of ways of skinning the cat. There's lots of options there on what to do. But first of all, you know, when you think about selling your house, you go, oh, geez. The real estate agent will come around and they'll go, oh, well, if you need to freshen up the paint, maybe do some landscaping. Look, can we do this? Maybe we need to get some home staging. So what are they doing? You're getting your home ready for sale.
Yeah.
For businesses, that process needs to happen a bit sooner, not tomorrow, not 2 months before you want to do it. It's years. And I think what we think, it's the emotional side. Am I ready? Because a lot of business owners, no one can do what I can do. That's the thing. So it's emotional. Are we ready for this? And so if you want to sell it outright, it's about looking at, okay, how can I make sure that if I leave this business, the day after it operates seamlessly? So it's systems and process, it's staffing. Two other point though, Ryan, there's obviously ways of also, this is a, you know, giving equity to staff is a great way of retaining your good staff, especially if you've had key managers or key people. It's a great way of, one, releasing some capital for yourself potentially, and different ways you can do that. But also it is a great way of going, well, we've got some good people here. They probably want, you see a lot in the trades do this quite well, where, you know, they've got a couple of really good project managers or team leaders, bring them in because, cool, I want to make sure I keep them. That gives them more responsibility. They've got ownership. But I also think that when you start that process, for example, is you've got to be aware that they're now a shareholder. They're an employee, but they're now a shareholder of the business. That changes your dynamic as well. So there's lots of, I guess, I wouldn't say consequence, but you've really got to think through, okay, and really plan this out in a controlled way. The big one, which you know, they, which I guess is well known, you know, we talk about, you know, farming and agriculture, you know, succession planning is a big topic with them because land values are huge. Mm. You've got obviously huge conversation about with what happens with the family, and that's the often, and you might have three kids. One kid wants to take on the farm, two don't. What do you want to do? You don't want to live one kid with all the debt. So, you know, so there's real emotive sides around these discussions. And if there's multiple directors, do they all want the same thing? One director go, I want to exit next week. And one's, well, no, I'm thinking 5 years. What's that mean? So I think what I would say around exit and maximizing value is start talking about it. What do you want?
Yeah.
And I think it links to probably what you, I'm guessing a bit, Ryan, but okay. But okay, we want to retire. What do we want that retirement to look like?
Yeah.
You know, and then businesses, there's two simple ways. Is okay, we build enough value in the business to sell it for X and exit it for, or can we build a model where we can start stepping away gradually, the business runs while still can give us a return, or do we just create an absolute monster that hopefully gives us enough return to give us the pot of money or whatever. So there's a number of ways of doing it, but it's about having a plan.
Yeah.
It's about having a plan.
It's a man that doesn't like planning much, but does it for a living. The I think I'm a strong believer that the day you start your business is the day you should, you know, plan your exit. And I think for a professional services, the traditional sense is they sell the book. They try and sell a relationship. Good luck. But then a low-hanging fruit is own the premises that you're in.
Yeah.
But the one that's underutilized, I think, is brand and also process.
Yeah, massively.
Because, you know, and that, the competition, without being too unkind, is shit. So, like, not financial advisors, not just in general. Like, take it podcast, for example.
Yeah.
So, the first three episodes, only 10% of people get to there.
Yeah.
The 23rd episode, another 10% of that. So 1% of people. Yeah. You're in the top 1% for making, you know, 23 podcasts. So I think, and then the competitors for the most part in a marketing component is how quickly can I sell this?
Yeah.
And you may, and then how quickly can I ignore the community? So take, for example, you make this beautiful content, people engage with it, you ignore every comment. Would you do that on the street? Someone walks past, hey Ryan, you just fucking just bump.
Yeah.
And then, or like using dating as a crossover, if you meet someone that night, you don't even know their name and you just go and pitch them immediately. Hey, would you like to come home with me? I don't understand where this trend started from.
Yeah.
I won't link you to that. But what do you think, either your learnings from growing business through the sales thing, smart ways to build a rapport or where to find your ideal clients, or even from a marketing side of things that you find are quite useful that businesses should think about if they're going to build brand?
I think it's interesting what you talked about the relationship there, because you know, one thing that business owners do well is often they build really good relationships with their not only just their customers but their suppliers, because it's their business. You know, it's my thing. I've got huge responsibility, so they do that. I think the one thing you talked about there though is how do you build a business that has scale and has a process behind it where anyone can start to do that? You know, and I guess that is then into sales account management, depending on what sort of business you're in, because that, I guess, is the value. Is if this, again, I talked about how that business start to tick post it. But I think one of the clients said to me, the clients were Tuesday, is they said, when we started this business, we always thought big. And I think the mentality of how you start your business, and it comes to your sales and marketing, is I had this one client, and he was in the scaffolding industry, and he's a big business now. And I was like, how did you grow? And he went, I just didn't have my mobile number on the side of my van, because that's what every other scaffolder is. So I made myself look super professional. I made myself look this bigger than I was. And so everyone thought, oh, he's massive, because I had this bigger perception than bigger other companies. Because and it's true. If you drive past a scaffolding car truck, what is it? 021 something. So we said, I had a perception. Another client of ours, he's in the landscaping industry. He wanted to go into higher end work. So what did he wanted to do? He made sure if our guys are going to go onto a multi-million-dollar house, we've got to look good.
Yeah.
So he has invested in the slickest uniforms, the great brand. So when the guys turn up and they've done some work at my house, they are super polite. They're great guys. You feel comfortable with them on your house, but they also look the part and great communicators. So I think you've got to kind of, when you talk about ideal client, who is that ideal client? What are, you know, put themselves in their shoes and what are the things you need to think about? And it's just small things, I think. It doesn't have to be this big, it just can be starting points of about how do we look, how we perceive. Because I think what people get confused with brand, they think is logo, they think of colors, they think of them a website, but brand is your interactions, isn't it? And I think it's any time I interact with a business is a reflection of the brand. So, you know, how do your staff greet customers when they come into your store? How do you answer your 0800 number? If it's, you can have the greatest looking website, but if this person's rude, that your brand's gone. So I think for business owners, they try and be everything of that. I'll answer the phone because no one can answer it as better as me. Well, I'll do all the customer quoting because no one can do it as better as me, and I don't trust them. Trust, that's a big thing for business owners. But like you said, Ryan, what's the process? Do we have, okay, what's the process of, we've got a new inquiry, how do we follow up that? We will follow it up within 24 hours. We will book an appointment. On that appointment, we will cover these five steps. You know, I'm simplifying a bit, but I think that for business owners, especially in that half a mil, 2 million space, even up bigger, it's always, oh, well, I could do it, so I'll just keep doing it. No one else can do it better than me. Well, okay, what are the steps you do? What's the process? So I think if you think of, you know, as someone said to me, a good sales process makes an average salesperson a good salesperson.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's true for most things, really.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's a few lessons in there. I mean, I think one of the most important things as a leader is recognizing you're not the best person for the job.
Yeah. It's very easy in my job. I'm not the accountant, so it's good.
Yeah. But that's hard. Like, you know, delegating and trust is, I find it incredibly hard. But then, you know, I keep reminding myself, like, talking to you or talking to Nick or Jaco Willink. I don't know if you know him.
Yeah.
He's a big advocate for decentralization because essentially, if we're sitting here, we're doing a strategic meeting, I'm saying this is what's going to happen in the future. I don't know. And then if it doesn't go to plan, I've just told you what you need to do and you have no control or input within it. So one, you're not motivated. Two, you didn't develop the skill set to create the idea. And who knows if I'm going to be right.
Yeah.
So why don't I just allow you the freedom to do it within a certain realm? And the realm for me is the value set.
Yeah.
So here's our values. Here's our mission. You make the call if it fits within that. If you're a little off or you need support. Okay. But I don't want to call you up every day. How are you going with the thing?
Yeah, where are you at this? And I think what I've seen in working in the accounting industry and the beauty of not being an accountant with is, like, I ask really dumb questions. But it's amazing when you ask a dumb question that people go, yeah, I'm actually not quite sure why we do that. Like, there's a lot of inertia that you get. And especially in small business, you know, business owners, they just keep doing things because that's all the way they, always the way they do it. And there's no one, you know, in most business owners, they're not accountable to anyone. It's them, or there might be some couple of other directors or whatever. So I guess having an advisor, having someone that just asks a dumb question and going, why are you doing that? And because often the answer goes, because we've always done it that way. Well, yeah. Does that make it right? And so, yeah, I guess, Ryan, you're right. Like, it is kind of an environment where people feel comfortable asking questions. It doesn't matter. Like, we talk about it. We have one of our values at Right Way is called embrace the collective genius, because we have a big belief. And I even tell it to the grads who join us. Like, ask questions, because you'll probably ask a question. We haven't thought about that. Like, because everyone's got different thoughts, different ideas. And I think you've got to embrace that. You've got to embrace individuality and people's backgrounds and stuff brings them different perspective, and that's a healthy thing. If you get the same group of people from the same kind of background, from the same sort of upbringing, you're probably going to get the same answer.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not hiring clones, I think that's you're hiring people that you can listen to, because, like,
but yeah, but people are scared of that.
Yeah, so, I get it. I do get it. Biggest trust issues you can imagine. I know too much about people to trust them, man. But that's the reality. Is what's the cost of not trusting them?
Yeah.
And, you know, at least say I hire all swimmers and we needed a boat and we could have got there 10 hours quicker.
But it's interesting about trust, isn't it? Because I'm a big believer, like, if we've got someone in our organization that we bring in, say it's a new staff member, Like, it's a pretty shit culture if you go, oh, I don't trust you, you've got to prove your worth. Well, gee, really? It's a bit, one, it's a bit of a sad view of life.
Yeah.
But two, like, call it, like, we've got to give a bit here. Like, cool, I trust you. And our job's to support you and put the, you know, the training, the guidance, the processes to make you be the best, you know, excel, whatever. But yeah, trust, I find it, you see in leadership weird things happen about the word trust. And, oh, well, they've got to prove their worth. Do they?
Like, yeah, no.
Or maybe we need to go, we trust you, but we've got to make sure we prepare you for the challenge ahead, or doing that meeting, or doing that thing. Oh, they ballsed it up. Well, what did we do? Did we just throw him off the diving board and then go, oh, geez, you can't swim? Bugger. Yeah.
I think responsibility is an incredible important thing.
Yeah.
I do genuinely struggle with the trusting part. So how I frame it to get through that, I don't come and prove your worth. They've already proved their word. Like, it's more trusting I'll be okay if something happens. So I focus on that. So I only trust people with things I can afford to lose, but I put myself in a position where I'm comfortable to lose it all. Because I don't think you can trust, because trust essentially is saying in the future, under these certain criteria, I believe you act a certain way. Don't know. So instead of even trying to unpack that, I'm just like, I'll just trust I'll be okay. I'll give you the freedom.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I'll learn.
It's you're right.
Shut me down, mate. I need to learn.
I think, you know, you think of, you know, in all, yeah, look at, you know, I think of our organization, we've got 35 odd staff. So the 35 variables, you could argue, in that. I guess, you know, you talked about it earlier, Ryan. It comes down to your values and culture. A big part, you know, values are not just nice stickers on the wall. Hopefully they do give some guidance to you, to thought process. But also, I think that the interesting thing you've got about trust and trying to give some trust to people is you want people to try some things. You want people to go, and you don't want people to be reckless. You know, be careful of that. But, you know, I've not done a meeting with a client before. So cool. Well, let's give you some training and stuff, but cool. We trust you to do it. If you make a mistake, cool. We'll learn from that. Because we talked about it earlier with sport, you learn from adversity. So I do think that a lot of people can worry about, oh, but what if? Well, yeah, okay, well, let's worry about if the what if happens, first of all, because the amount of time people worry about the things that then never happen is the first thing. But I think part of giving a bit of trust to people is going, it's like if something happens, we'll make sure we've got some, you know, the process and stuff, so you don't make that the big boo boo or big mistake. But if you do, it's all right. Most of the time, 99% of them make the mistakes are not big, and people learn from them and they'll be better for it. So I think you can see this in some organizations, I guess, where there's a lot of control, the old micromanagement thing, and people are stifled, and you worry why your business is not growing. You wonder why you're tired. You wonder why you're stressed. Well, you're not letting people make decisions. You're not letting people try things. You're not being innovative, and you're wearing it all because you're kind of restricting people. So, you know, but it comes down to, you've got to have good training, good process, and good culture around that. An openness so people go, hey, I just want to talk through this. I'm prepared. Or, hey, I did this. What do you think? And people know they're not going to get yelled at. Because the minute you get yelled at, you ain't going to do it again. That's for sure.
Inspired.
Yeah.
Got all the thoughts whirring around your head. This little pays me nothing. I'm going to show him. You don't want to create that. Like, that's the reality. Because, yeah, what is a mistake? It's just, you know, it's an exploration of the truth. You know, you pushed a barrier, it went the wrong way, or you made a mistake. It's not a big deal. Funnily enough, when you talk, just to bring an investment component about the what if, more money has actually been lost in the preparation of a recession.
Yeah,
which is interesting. That's so really interesting. Like, take for example the S&P 500, so 500 biggest companies in the US. If you miss the best 10 trading days over a 20-year period, just 10 days, your return was a third less.
I've heard about that before. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, so everyone's like, oh, I'm, you know, all in cash, I'm ready to pick the moment. But just being out of the market and not knowing when it's going to go well, and that self-fulfilling prophecy in leadership or in your business is like, I think you should always be fiscally conscious. Personally, I think pay you the bare necessities to enjoy a life you're comfortable with.
Yeah.
And set that as a behavior.
Yeah.
Because I meet clients, they earn $500,000 and save nothing. or people saying, oh, I'm struggling on, you know, whatever, 70 grand.
Correct. So, yeah.
So be fiscally conscious, but, you know, you can't self-fulfill the prophecy before the prophecy has happened.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think in the world we live in now, where there's lots of information, there's lots of advice, everyone's got an opinion on a podcast.
but
you know, like, there's lots to digest, whether it's business owners or individuals. And sometimes less is more, you know. And I think, especially when decision making, especially in business, you know, it is about clarity, it's about confidence in the decisions. And that comes back to an understanding. And that's why we're a big believer in, you know, financial understanding your numbers is so important. And things that you know when you're a $500,000 business versus what you need to know at $2 million, very different, and there's a more detail to it and whatever. But understanding the mechanics of that means you can make good decisions. And I guess it's the same with investing, isn't it? Like, I think if you've got good advice, you've got good people you trust, you can make decisions, you know?
And similar with business, never give... Like, where I see a lot of businesses get ripped off or fail is they instill too much belief in a certain partnership's skill and understanding.
Yeah.
So you give them, just to, you know, contradict myself, you're aware of the process, but you don't do it.
Yeah.
Same thing with advisors. If some advisors, you know, running out of breath telling you about all these amazing returns and what they're going to do, I think you need a baseline understanding of the actual product or of the business partner and what they do. But in essence, don't, you know, outsource. Same thing with the business. If you don't want to do it, don't worry. Peace will pay us for peace of mind. They're all capable of doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
They spend, you know, 2 months learning finance, they've got it.
Correct.
There's not much to it. Like.
Yeah, and I think you're right there, Ryan. But I think the interesting thing you see, and I think accounting is a really good example. I think marketing is a really good example, is, especially digital marketing, is I could be a business owner and it's an area I don't have much exposure to. So there's... You know, you see it. There's plenty of people that promise the world and you go, okay, cool, I'm going to get a return. You don't understand. I'm not saying you need to know everything about marketing or how, but you need to understand the basics so you can still make an informed decision. I think, you know, your role as a business owner is to be well-rounded in your business acumen. We see this in financials and let's be frank, since, you know, the GFC 2008, it's been pretty good. It's in a good environment. Economy's growing. So, you know, sweet as. And it was suddenly we hit the reset. You know, we hit COVID. You know, I remember that day and our phones did not stop ringing for a week of people going, holy fuck, what the heck's happening? Have I got any cash? No idea, because your zero's not been updated in 3 months. So we probably kind of, oh, is that important? Yeah. Like, so I think what COVID's done has actually probably highlighted the importance of knowing your numbers a little bit. But understanding how your numbers make up, because the numbers are results. So how did you get a result? What can you do to influence that? It's fundamental for you to grow your business to scale. But then also to, if you've got a bit of knowledge, means that you've also got a good chance of getting a good partner and knowing when you're getting good advice and not good advice as well.
True. Well said. Well, we're at the hour mark, mate.
Oh, we're at the hour. Gosh, yeah. That's flown by, Ryan. Flown by.
I'll take that as a compliment. What would be some leaving remarks that you would want, like a point, whether it's a young version of yourself, whether it's whatever wakes you up in the morning and you just want this opportunity to say to the world, and then also how do they find you?
I'm a bigger believer. You've got to be yourself in life. And I think in the business world, it's got better, to be brutally honest. I think personalities come through a lot more in business, but you know, there are some organizations that try and put you into boxes.
Yeah.
And I think be who you are, you know, understand your strengths, understand your weaknesses, try and, you know, double up on the strengths and minimize your weaknesses a little bit. So want to learn, I think, is a big thing for people. Just have fun with it. Like, you know, I enjoy what I do. I try and keep it pretty lighthearted. Graham, who's our owner of our business, one of his things he always talks about, like, this should be fun. Like, we spend all this time doing it. Like, of course, there's going to be tough days and we've all got them and we've all got, you know, things were happening. Oh, geez. But you've got to enjoy what you do. And I think especially for business owners can feel a bit trapped by the business. And so, you know, if that's the case, well... Yeah, we've seen that a lot post-pandemic. A lot of people have gone, that's it. I didn't want that again. That's too much. And the next, and that's fine. That's cool. But yeah, just don't be a slave to it.
Yeah.
Your business, yeah, business owners get big, can become big slaves of their business. It can get away from them. But reach out. There's some good people out there. Obviously, there's us, but there's lots of good accountants that can really help you. You know, be there for you. Be there on the end of the phone when you need it. So yeah. And I guess if you want to find us, rightway.co.nz, if you want to reach out. But yeah.
Jeez, I was going to start worrying about you. You didn't even do a pitch, but
no.
I think that really is what life is about. Like, businesses just give a disproportionate amount of value to people that could be clients or could bring in clients.
Yeah.
But not have the mindset that you need anything.
Yeah.
So thanks for coming. You embody that.
That was awesome. That was good. Cheers. Hope it was good.